You're just starstruck. And then at the same time, he's becoming a real person. He's not this sort of like two-dimensional icon. He gives you focused attention. And I think at that age, you want to be important and you want to be noticed and loved. So this is powerful attraction.
James Safechuck in the documentary Leaving Neverland. The film features him and another man, Wade Robson. Both say they were molested by Michael Jackson when they were children, although they have denied it previously. Later in the show, we'll talk about why young victims of sexual abuse often don't realize they're being abused and don't realize it until much later in life, if at all. First, though, Governor Gavin Newsom today signed his first non-budget-related bill. And the subject? Charter schools. That bill will subject charter schools to the same public records and open meetings laws as traditional schools. This comes after teachers went on strike in Oakland and here in L.A., demanding, among other things, more rules for charters. Those strikes highlighted the problems charters pose for unionized teachers. Charters, as a rule, do not have a unionized workforce. But there is a reason these schools have caught on. When run right, parents see them as an attractive option. Let's go more in depth now on the pros and cons of charters with Pedro Noguera. He's a professor at the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
Great to have you. All right. So tell us more about this bill the governor is signing today. It's basically a transparency and accountability law. What would it change for LA public schools?
Well, it won't change much for LA. I mean, I think for charter schools generally, it'll be an important step for ensuring some degree of public accountability and how public monies are used and how decisions are made. And hopefully we can see whether or not kids are being pushed out who should be served, which has long been suspected at some charters. Mm. And so the main thing is it begins to create a more level playing field for charter schools and public schools.
Right. And so they'll have to actually make their budgets open and available for people, for the public, to see exactly how they're spending their money.
Absolutely. And given, you know, the charter schools have, you know, always maintained that they are, in fact, public schools because they get public dollars. And so given that they're getting public dollars, the need for transparency, I think, is even greater. And I think this is particularly an issue for the for-profit, privately run charter schools where there have been several cases of corruption.
Mm, right. Well, California in general is seen as kind of the Wild West when it comes to charters. They're not very well regulated or at all, that, you know, in general, not the way traditional schools are. So is this the first step to even more regulation?
It could be. And they have to be careful that the benefits that we associate with charters don't get killed in that process. You know, charters were originally seen as a way to bring innovation to public education. And that was largely hasn't happened because too many often policymakers set it up as a competition between charters and public schools. It tends to be that because charters have greater flexibility around state regulations, in some cases, they can do things and serve certain populations of kids more effectively, such as kids in foster care or kids who've been formerly incarcerated. So we want to know if they are working, what makes them work, and what regulations might need to change for traditional public schools so they can be better at serving those kids as well. So I think, you know, public education in general is overregulated, and so we need to learn from charters where some easing off of the regulations could be beneficial.
Where do you think it is overregulated? Where could traditional schools learn from charters?
Well, I'll give you an example. Hiring is a big issue. You know, if you're at a private school or a charter school and you have a bachelor's degree and you're qualified to teach a subject, even without a credential, you can be hired. In public schools, traditionally, you have to have a credential in the subject. Now, there are good reasons for that. We don't want unqualified people in our schools. At the same time, there are people who've demonstrated expertise because of their work that are not able to teach. And we have a teaching shortage. So easing some of those up would be helpful.
Well, one thing that a lot of people point to is that because of union rules, district schools can hang on to teachers long after they have been effective in the classroom. So teachers who aren't really doing great work in the classroom still get to teach because of seniority. That doesn't happen in charter schools.
Right. So, I mean, in here, I think we want teachers to have due process. We don't want to see, you know, charter schools have an incentive to get rid of more veteran teachers because they often get paid more. We don't want that. We want teachers who are veterans, who are career teachers, who develop greater expertise over time. At the same time, we don't want it to be so difficult to remove a teacher who clearly shouldn't be in a classroom. That undermines the teaching profession and respect for it. So that's why I think striking the right balance is what we're after, and we could learn a lot from some of the flexibility that charters have.
Right. And so another thing that charter school proponents point out, or at least in the independently run charter schools, is that there is a lot more school-based control, that one of the problems is a district or a statewide set of rules that the local school has to adhere to that may not be applicable. And in this instance in particular, if there's a bad teacher in the classroom, why can't the principal make the decision and go, you know what, we're taking this teacher out?
Well, I agree with that. And I think it would be a mistake to say, let's just treat charter schools the way we treat all public schools, because in fact there are some regulations that we should be getting rid of, and we should be doing things to ease up the job of schools. So I don't think we want to go to the path of just taking away some of the autonomy and flexibility that charter schools have. I think we want to learn from it and figure out how do we bring some of those advantages into traditional public schools.
What's another area? We've been talking about teacher hiring and firing. What's another area where you think charter schools do better than traditional schools, or where traditional schools could learn from charter schools?
So procurement of services. If a charter school needs a new desk, they can go to a supplier, Staples, wherever, to get the desk, have the desk within a day or two. A public school traditionally it'll take much longer. It could take months for them to get the desk because they have a very elaborate process through which they have to go through to make purchases. Now, some of that is to ensure that there isn't nepotism, and so there are some good reasons why we have those controls, but it shouldn't take months to get a desk.
And what about flexibility in the curriculum itself?
There, I think flexibility is important, and the Common Core standards allow for flexibility, but you still want standards. What you don't want is to have a situation where kids in Beverly Hills are learning something very different than kids in South Central or kids in the Central Valley. We want kids to be exposed to common standards regardless of where they live, since those kids will also be competing for college later. We do want flexibility in how teachers choose materials, books, et cetera, but we also want to give teachers guidance on how to meet the needs of populations like English learners and children with learning disabilities that are often not well served. So we want some degree of standards, but we also want flexibility and autonomy.
Are charter schools subject to the same testing requirements as traditional schools?
They are. And that's one of the things that we often compare. What we don't know is a lot of times whether or not that the students they serve, how they might be different. You know, so there are many charters, for example, that will admit students on the basis of a lottery. But we know that there are certain populations that usually are not in the lottery, don't participate. Undocumented people are often underrepresented in a lottery. Homeless kids are underrepresented in a lottery. So we need to make sure that we don't exacerbate, and I think this is a big concern in Los Angeles and in Oakland, where these issues have been raised, exacerbate the inequities among schools so that charter schools end up serving a more privileged population than our public schools.
Okay. And do you think that the union here, I mean, they made charter schools, you know, the boogeyman, for lack of a better word, in as well as Austin Buettner, who supports charter schools, superintendent, in their latest strike. Do you think that was smart on their part, or should they have been a little more subtle on it?
I think they have a good reason to raise it. L.A. has more charter schools than any district in the country, and all indications are we have too many. We have charter schools that are under-enrolled. We have public schools that are under-enrolled. There's been no strategy to how we go about authorizing charter schools for which neighborhoods and for which kids. So in the absence of a strategy, we do need a moratorium. We need to not create so many schools. We need to think about what schools do we need, and should the schools we need be charter or traditional public schools, which schools will have the best ability to serve our kids? Those are the questions we should be asking, not whether or not we should simply limit them. But right now, given the glut of schools and the fact that we have declining enrollment, we need to clearly stop what we've been doing.
But I guess I'm wondering, the environment is pretty poisonous now. And so how do you have a situation where both sides can get together and learn from each other, as we've been discussing, that we could take good ideas from both to create better education for everyone? But how do you do that against the background of these strikes where charter and traditional schools were just pitted against each other?
Well, that's going to be a challenge, a leadership challenge. And, you know, we need the school board. I'm not sure if they're capable of this leadership challenge, but because they're very polarized themselves. But other city leaders, civic leaders, to come together and say, look, it's not in our interest to have this kind of polarized environment. We need to collaborate. We need to figure out how to work together. You know, it sometimes in the same family, we'll have a parent that will choose a charter school for one child, a public school for another. And so we don't want to divide families or pit families against each other. And that's happened. And I think that's really unfortunate. I'm not sure if we have the kind of leadership we need in Los Angeles or elsewhere to begin to bring people together. But that's what we need to do.
All right. Pedro Noguera, professor of education at the Graduate School of Education and Information Studies at UCLA. Always great to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, the documentary about two men who say they were sexually abused by Michael Jackson as kids is raising questions about how children process sexual abuse. Often they don't think of it as abuse until much later in life. We'll have that next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, so it's time for our TV segment we call TV on the Radio.
No one told you that was...
This is serious.
Gumby, no wonder.
There are the four bids. The actual retail price is...
Back in June, AT&T acquired HBO's parent company. It was part of a massive $85 billion deal between AT&T and Time Warner. Now that the dust has settled, AT&T is starting to make major changes. It's consolidating divisions, and it's put a new executive in place, Robert Greenblatt, to oversee entertainment, and that includes HBO. That explains the departure of the man who was HBO CEO since 2013. Richard Plepler greenlit hit shows like Game of Thrones, Girls, Veep. He announced last week he's resigning. So what does it mean for the future of prestige programming at HBO? Joe Flint is a media and entertainment reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and he joins us now. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. All right, tell us more about him and what role he played at HBO.
Sure. Richard had been with HBO for nearly three decades. He was approaching 28 years when he resigned, and he really worked in every facet of the company. You know, he originally started in communications, but even when he was a lowly communications executive, and I put lowly in quotes, He had a presence and an aura that was, you know, much bigger than the position he held. I remember when I was a young reporter going to interview the then heads of HBO, and Richard would be in the room. And Richard would often talk as much as the other executives, and often in a more concise and clear manner about what HBO's agenda and strategy was. He rose up through the ranks as other executives moved on to different positions, and he became a programming executive and then ultimately the chairman and chief executive of the whole enterprise, which included programming, but also the decision to launch a direct-to-consumer service as well and to enter into new technological fields.
Did he say why he resigned?
He issued a letter to the staff saying that it was time for him to move on. I think this was one of those things where you're shocked but not surprised.
Mm-hmm.
As you mentioned, AT&T had bought Time Warner, and they've since renamed Time Warner Warner Media. And although the deal closed last year, It was only last week when the final court appeals that the government had been waging to try to stop the deal ran out of steam, and they were defeated. And AT&T more quickly began to strategize or put into place a strategy it had been mowing for a while, which was going to consolidate much of the company. And in doing so, a lot of the autonomy and freedom that Richard Plepler had enjoyed for so many years at HBO was going to disappear. I think if you talk to Richard, he would tell you he understood why they were doing these things, but it was also not the job he had signed on for, and that it was best for him to get out of the way.
Well, can you explore that a little bit more? What does it mean in terms of the programming? Does it mean that the programming will change significantly, that he didn't feel like he could usher in the kind of prestige programming that he had overseen over the years under this new management?
Obviously, time will tell on the programming. I don't necessarily think it was strictly related to that he wouldn't get to do the programming he wanted to do or that HBO had done under him and his current team of programming executives. I think it was just more about being the quarterback and calling your own plays. Under Time Warner, his boss was Jeff Bukas, who was a former HBO chief executive himself, and Jeff gave Richard a lot of room and a lot of leeway. And the new owners, when new owners come in, they don't always do that. And it was sort of clear that AT&T had different plans and ideas. And, you know, Richard was not only going to have to run his play calling by the new coaches, his playbook was going to get a lot smaller. Now, to your question about programming, I think the one thing that Plepler and AT&T agreed on is that HBO needs more money to invest in programming. So I'm not so sure that Richard was concerned about that. I think there's always a little bit of concern about how many shows you're doing that will protect HBO's brand. But to be fair to HBO, for every Wire and Game of Thrones, there was an Eastbound and Down. There was Vice Principals. They like to talk about themselves as if they're an art museum, but they had other shows as well that you might say had a more populist appeal. Going forward, I interviewed John Stankey. He is the chief executive of Warner Media, and asked him about HBO's programming going forward, and would we see them adapting a Netflix-like strategy of just throwing stuff at the wall and seeing what sticks. And he said, no, he's not interested in HBO becoming so bloated that you no longer recognize the brand and that has been built there after so many years. He would like to see them do more shows so that there's something new on more, and he would like to see them maybe broaden their audience and their appeal a little bit. But he indicated he's not in any way interested in premiering 50 new shows a week.
Who's going to take over then? Who's going to run it? And does that person have the same ideas and the same goals as Plepler, or does he have a different vision?
Well, first, the head of programming for HBO under Plepler, Casey Bloys, he's still there, not going anywhere as far as we know, at least for now. But there is a new executive coming in. Warner Media has basically, in this consolidation they're doing where they're combining a lot of the HBO and Turner networks, TNT and TBS, together, they've brought in an executive, Bob Greenblatt, who used to be the president of NBC and prior to that was a president of Showtime. And he's kind of going to serve as the chief content officer, if you will, for the Warner Entertainment Group, which will be HBO and the Turner networks. So he's going to have a strong say in the shows that HBO makes, the shows that Turner makes, even perhaps deciding which shows best fit which network. I will say that Bob Greenblatt is a veteran entertainment executive. He's well regarded. It was during his stewardship of Showtime that they actually became something of a competitor to HBO after so many years of being an afterthought. He greenlit Nurse Jackie. He greenlit Californication. He greenlit several shows there, Weeds, that put Showtime on the map as a creative place and a spot for original programming. And at NBC, broadcast TV is a different medium, certainly, but he did make some successful shows that I think you could argue would work on any platform, such as the family drama This Is Us and the comedy The Good Place. So it's not like a novice is coming in to take over programming for these operations. He is experienced, but will be interesting to see where his tastes do lie. And I think it'll be most interesting to see that in the world of the documentaries. Sometimes it got lost under the Game of Thrones and Sopranos and all those big event type shows they do. But I certainly hope that however HBO goes going forward, that those sort of programs remain as big a part of it to them as the dramas and comedies.
Well, Joe, thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Joe Flint, media and entertainment reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Well, we can't talk about HBO this week without talking about Leaving Neverland. That's the documentary about sexual abuse allegations against Michael Jackson. It features two men who say Jackson molested them when they were children. There's been some backlash against HBO by Jackson supporters and also backlash against Jackson's accusers, also against Oprah Winfrey, who had an interview with the two of them, because they had previously denied that any sexual misconduct had taken place. One of them actually testified in Jackson's defense at two separate trials. But often young victims of sexual abuse don't realize they were abused, and they don't understand it until much later, until they're older, if at all. Joining us now to talk about this is Bessel van der Kolk. He's the author of the book, The Body Keeps the Score, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma. And he teaches psychiatry at Boston University School of Medicine. Welcome to you.
Hi.
Nice to have you. And Gail Goodman is here, too. She's a psychology professor at UC Davis, where she specializes in child abuse and memory of trauma. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
Bessel, let's begin with you. How common is it that children, when they're adults, finally realize that what happened to them was abuse?
It's quite common, actually. We quite often see people who say, oh, I had a perfectly happy childhood. I don't remember anything before age 12 or something. What's really striking, kids really adapt to the realities that they live in because they don't know how else it could be.
Mm-hmm. They don't know what abuse is.
They don't know what abuse is. What they get is what they know. They haven't read a book about what normal childhoods are like.
And they don't even have the language to say it, right?
Yeah, but they don't have a comparison.
Yeah.
So if they get scared and upset, they just mainly get confused and shut themselves down and try to make feelings go away because they don't know how to deal with this, basically.
And then is there a typical thing that triggers them to rethink that when they're older?
Yeah, very often it's having your own kids and seeing how kids are really very innocent and very different, or just growing up and becoming aware of how scared you are of certain situations, like sexual situations, and how triggered you are by certain things. They say, oh, yeah, I remember being so scared when I was a kid.
Yeah. So that was the case with Wade Robson, one of Jackson's accusers. He said it wasn't until he had a son of his own that he realized he was abused by Michael Jackson. And James Safechuck says it was because when Robson came out with the allegations, he realized he was abused.
Yeah. But kids are mainly confused about these things. You know, if you don't talk about something, you don't have an internal reality for it.
Gail, you're wrapping up a study where you looked at this exact phenomenon, how perceptions of childhood abuse change over time by the victims. What did you discover?
Oh, thank you. Well, we have a fair number of people in our sample. These are individuals who had been investigated for child maltreatment in their childhoods, and now we're interviewing them as adults. And we've had a fair number of people who had denied sexual abuse as children or just wouldn't talk about it. And now as adults, when we interview them, they admit that it was going on. They may have been told not to tell in childhood or have been too embarrassed or thought they might get in trouble. And now as adults, they're willing to talk about it.
Is it harder for men than for women to talk about it?
Yes, we and several others have found that in their research. Men have a harder time discussing these kinds of experiences, both in childhood and in adulthood. It appears that they are often more embarrassed or feel more secretive about victimization, including sexual victimization. Probably seems more confusion about it as well. Some of the studies, such as by Kathy Whittem in New York, have found that males are more likely to vary in their definition of what constitutes child sexual abuse. So in some of our studies, for instance, where we had documentation of sexual abuse from childhood and then later interviewed the victims, some of the males will say, well, coaches just do that kind of thing.
Hmm.
Yeah, but it was prosecuted as child sexual abuse because coaches really aren't just supposed to do that kind of thing.
Well, I guess that's some self-protective mechanism to say, oh, I wasn't a victim, I wasn't sexually abused.
It appears that way, yes.
And Bessel, your book has the title in it, The Body Keeps Score. How does the body keep score when the brain is saying, oh, nothing bad happened?
Well, your body gets shut down, or you start reacting in particular ways to things, or you get frightened in response to things, you clam up, you become excited about things that other people don't get excited by. It plays itself out in the automatic physical responses that people have. Yeah.
What do you mean excited by? Like,
well, people may get excited about being beaten up, or may get excited about things that they are embarrassed to get excited by.
Like a sexual reaction you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah.
So this idea that Michael Jackson's defenders are saying, well, look, this guy, Robson, he's testified for Michael Jackson in his defense, and he said nothing happened. In one trial, he was a child. He was around 11. And in the subsequent one, he was an adult, but a young adult. He was in his early 20s. How long does it take for someone to realize that they were abused typically?
I don't think it's typical. Mm-hmm. I've met people in their 70s who realized that when they were 70. I've known people in their teens who realized it, and anywhere in between.
There's this idea that we've heard a lot when it comes to child sex abuse, and that is the idea of grooming, that predators, they groom children in a certain way, that there's a pattern of trying to, I guess, in a way, seduce them. Oprah Winfrey used that word in the interview, that this is kind of a form of seduction.
Well, kids don't know what the rules are, and kids look up to adults in general. Kids enormously idealize grown-ups, and so grown-ups can really set them up to say this is normal, and that's what people do when they really love each other, and this means you're special.
Mm, wow.
One part about grooming I wanted to mention is that in some of our studies and other studies where the perpetrator has recorded actually the assaults and the grooming process, you can see what the perpetrators do in terms of befriending the children, gradually seducing them, becoming more and more sexual with them, telling them not to tell, sometimes blackmailing them with photographs they've taken, and gradually involving the child more and more in the process. And when children feel implicated that they've done something wrong or that they might get in trouble, that is also a mechanism that's used to have children not disclose what's going on.
Mm-hmm. So that guilt must be really powerful and last a very long time.
Yes, it can last a lifetime. But for other children and adults in particular, more and more are coming out with their stories of what happened and their accounts of what happened, partly because it is more accepted in society now.
Yeah. So what about for kids who do understand what's happening or do understand when someone is trying? Like, how do they know that it's wrong versus a kid who believes that this is just natural and part of a regular relationship?
Well, I don't know that that's quite been studied yet at a scientific level, but I certainly have seen in our sample the loyalty that children have, whether they realize it's wrong or not, to the perpetrator often is very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the person is dependent on the other. So we've had cases, for instance, where a 12-year-old is impregnated by her father, and the father's telling the child not to tell, and so are other relatives. And the children don't tell, but because they're pregnant, it comes out, and DNA analysis will show who the father is. So you can see a range of reaction, but very often it's a secrecy issue and an attachment issue as well.
The predators also seem to have a nose for kids who come from difficult circumstances. And if kids grow up with parents who are absent or drug addicted or preoccupied or depressed, they target those kids. And these kids are hungry for affection. And kids are little love machines, and they will really get affection wherever they can get it. I've testified on behalf of about 100 men who were abused as kids by Catholic priests, and they were hungry for affection. And so the priests really groomed them to be told they're special, you're safe here, I'll take care of you. And they had nobody else to tell it to, because oftentimes their own parents were not there to take care of them.
We recently actually published a study that validates that in several ways, where the children who were being sexually abused by someone outside the family were less likely to disclose it to their own parents if their own parents were emotionally abusive or physically abusive of the child, where parents have basically punished the child there's lack of trust there on the child's part with the parent. And so those children are more likely to keep the secret.
Does most abuse, though, happen in the home by someone who lives with the child or knows the child very well?
Overwhelming data, most kids are abused by their own caregivers. Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Gail Goodman. She's a distinguished professor of psychology at UC Davis, where she specializes in child abuse and trauma. And Bessel van der Kolk is author of the best-selling book, The Body Keeps the Score, Brain, Mind, and Body in the Healing of Trauma. He also teaches psychiatry at Boston University School of Medicine. Coming up, why women are more likely to study abroad in college than guys.
They don't like to leave their friends. They're very influenced by their peers. And they could be members of athletic teams, clubs, fraternities, or just their friends. If their friends don't study abroad, they don't study abroad.
That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. For a lot of students, studying abroad is a really important part of the college experience. You get to know other cultures, you can learn a language, see the world. Also, it can help you be more attractive to employers when you leave college. But only a third of students who study abroad are guys, and it's been that way for about a decade now. Jeff Salingo is here to help us understand why. He wrote about it for The Atlantic. Hi.
It's good to be here.
Great to have you. Okay, did you yourself study abroad?
I did not. I was a boy who didn't study abroad.
Well, I was a girl who did. So here is the illustration of your entire piece right here in this interview. So why didn't you study abroad, and why do you think men aren't studying abroad as much as women are?
I didn't study abroad because I didn't want to leave campus. I was doing different activities on campus that I didn't want to leave. And that's one of the reasons why men don't leave. They don't like to leave their friends. They're very influenced by their peers in college. So they could be members of athletic teams, clubs, fraternities, or just their friends. If their friends don't study abroad, they don't study abroad.
But why isn't that the same with women? They're social too.
Yeah, they're social too. Women tend to think of college as gaining experiences, not only for their lives, but for their jobs. And men just don't approach college that way. They tend to be what I call spectators to college. They kind of just go with the flow. And if perhaps they think about going overseas, they tend to do that very late, where women kind of plan this out before they go to college, according to research.
Hmm. So men are spectators. That's an interesting description. So they're not fully active members of the college experience?
They're not fully active in engaged in college. And this is not just on study abroad, but in so many ways. We see this in the classroom, outside the classroom. Just women are naturally more mature when they go to college, and they tend to engage in college in different ways, including study abroad.
And is it also a factor that there are just more women in college?
Yes, there are definitely more women in college. They now account for about 56% of all the undergraduates in college, which is up from the low 40s in the 1970s. But even with that change, women has always had have always studied abroad at greater rates than men. This is mostly historical. Part of it was because you know, women in college went abroad for art and culture very early in the early 1900s. And also parents perceived study abroad as a safe way for their daughters to travel. They would let their sons kind of go over and backpack throughout Europe without any sort of adults around, but their daughters had to go study abroad.
Interesting. So are there particular majors that are more attractive for men to study abroad and more disciplines that men are more likely to study when they do go abroad, typically?
Yeah, and I think a lot of this also played into majors. You know, women tended to major in things like foreign language and humanities, which used to be more popular among study abroad. But that has also changed in recent years. Actually, the biggest groups that now go abroad are majors that are actually pretty popular with men, or actually very popular with men. The STEM majors, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math, and business, are the two most popular majors. And that's been a big switch since the earlier part of this decade when humanities and social sciences really led going abroad.
Can you really get something academically out of studying abroad? I mean, you can get a lot out of studying abroad, don't get me wrong, learning a language, learning a culture, having a great experience, learning about life. But does it really help you academically?
Well, there's been a lot of a talk about how, you know, the classes are easier. In some cases, you're not taking your own university's classes, which is one of the reasons why STEM majors never went away, because engineering, for example, had so many requirements to graduate that they didn't really want their students going abroad. That's starting to change now, especially with programs that are run by the university where the students might be attending, where they build this into the curriculum, studying abroad. And they also put internships abroad as well to give students a global internship experience, which is important, especially to men who see college as a means, or actually all students, see college as a means to getting a job.
Well, is it? I mean, do employers look at that and say, oh, this person spent a year in Paris, I'm going to hire them?
Well, it may not be the only reason, but, you know, in an age when you're trying to stand out and the economy is more global, I think that if you had a real experience abroad, again, that you just didn't go and sit around and enjoy the culture and the food and the drink of Paris or Spain or Italy or wherever you might have been, that you actually had an experience there that helped, that might assist you in getting a job, which is one of the reasons why among men, particularly the Middle East and Asia, are very popular with men when they do go abroad, because they see that as helping them in the job market later on.
So is there a move on the part of college campuses or anyone to get more men involved in doing this?
There is. They haven't had much success. Some colleges, for example, require every student to study abroad. And even in those cases, when they do, men tend to do it at the very last minute. So they tend to do it their senior year. And they tend to go on what are shorter trips, right? So study abroad now is very popular as something you do over winter break, for example, or over summer break. You don't necessarily do it for an entire semester. And men are much more likely than women to take those shorter trips abroad. There's also a push to really make this a kind of a peer effect, so that whether you're part of a club or whether you're part of a sports team, to get you abroad with those students. And then the final thing is what I talked about earlier, is this idea of it could help you in the job market. So by pushing that, particularly with men, they think that can help. But even with all those changes, women are still much more likely than men to study abroad.
And what's in it for the colleges? Why do they want their students to study abroad?
They want their students to study abroad. Well, first of all, they're able to take more students on campus when their students go abroad. So they're able to have additional tuition pay in students on campus. So there's a financial reason that that colleges like their students to study abroad. But they do think that in a global information economy where students are going to be working with people from different cultures, that studying abroad, especially at a young age, helps you kind of understand what the rest of the world is like, and can help you understand students from different cultures and different backgrounds when they get back on campus. So it's part of trying to enculturate students into differences in people, not only in the U.S., but across the world.
Do you regret not studying abroad in college?
There are days, but I had a great experience on campus. I was able to be editor of the student newspaper, which I don't think I would have been if I studied abroad. But there are moments when I'm now traveling that I wish I wish I had done it when I was in college, when I had more freedom, less money, but more freedom.
That's always the trade-off. Jeff Salengo, contributing editor to The Atlantic. Thank you.
It was great to be here.
Coming up, the winner of architecture's highest prize was announced today. He's an 87-year-old Japanese architect who designed LA's Mocha Grand. More on that next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Japanese architect Arata Isozaki has won the 2019 Pritzker Prize. That's like the Nobel Prize for architects. It's really a big deal for architects. Isozaki is 87 years old. His buildings are all over the world. Here in LA, he designed the Mocha building on Grand Avenue downtown. Carolina Miranda writes the Culture High and Low column for the LA Times. She's also a regular contributor here at Press Play, and she joins us now to tell us more about Arata Isozaki. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, great to have you. Okay, so was this a big surprise or not? Was he on the short list?
I think it was a little bit of a surprise because I think a lot of people had thought that the Pritzker had simply passed Isozaki by, that this was an architect who had his heyday in the 80s and 90s, that people around him had received the Pritzker. His mentor, Kenzo Tange, had received the Pritzker. One of his colleagues, Fumihiko Maki, had received the Pritzker. And so it felt a little bit like a throwback, but I think for some people also a recognition of this influential and highly unusual career.
Yeah. So tell us about his building here in LA. That seems to be something straight out of the 80s.
It is straight out of the 80s. Absolutely. He designed the Museum of Contemporary Art on Grand Avenue, that kind of sunken red sandstone temple across from the Broad Museum, just in case you haven't been there. Mm-hmm. And it is one of his more iconic and more important buildings. It was his first major international commission. At the time that he took the commission in the early 1980s, he had not worked outside of Japan. And at the time that the museum opened in 1986, the only other project he'd done in the United States was the interiors of the Palladium nightclub in New York City.
Oh, wow.
So the museum was a big deal. And I think it was a big deal for a number of reasons. Obviously, a big move for LA to open its own contemporary art museum. It was part of this plan to develop Bunker Hill as part of this urban redevelopment plan. And I think it was also this moment for this type of architecture, this postmodern, avoiding the boxy forms and opting for a series of shapes all spread out of a plaza. So you go to Mocha and you see squares, and there's a barrel vault library that you walk under to get into the museums. There's the pyramids that mark the skylights of the museums. There are all of these different shapes going on, and that is a very iconic part of his work. And in Mocha, I think one of the first places where he really got to play out some of these ideas on a grand scale.
How is the Pritzker Prize determined? You have pointed out, and this is really eye-opening for me, I had no idea, that among the jury, along with other architects, sits Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer.
Yes.
I mean, what? What? How is he determining who wins the Pritzker?
He has been a part of the Pritzker Committee actually for many years now. Apparently is an architecture aficionado, and it is determined by a jury that is comprised mostly of architects. I would say Stephen Breyer is the outlier. It's art critics and architects. And they get together every year, and really it's a plum assignment. They get together and they visit buildings all over the world, and then they determine who should get the Pritzker Prize.
Okay, that sounds fun. So they get to globetrot, hang out in cool buildings, and vote.
Exactly, exactly. When I inevitably leave journalism, I'd like to just submit my name for that job.
Okay, tell us more about how he formed his ideas and what his influences were.
Well, I think this is someone that is a really interesting architect because he is someone that emerges in post-war Japan. And you have to imagine what that looked like. He was 14 years old when the bombs were dropped on Nagasaki. He saw his own hometown, Otai, which is in southern Japan, leveled during U.S. Allied bombings. You know, this is someone who grew up in a landscape where there was literally a void of architecture, cities reduced to rubble, and almost this clean slate that that you could really begin with a whole new range of ideas. And one of the formative things that he did in the 1950s is he traveled the world. He went to Europe. He visited all of the important structures in Rome. He traveled the U.S. He was in France. He visited the cathedral in Chartres. And all of those influences found their way into his work. So, for example, part of the reason he chose that red unfinished sandstone for Moca is he was looking for a material that would refract California light, and he was looking to have a contrast with all of the shiny, I would say, boring glass towers.
You know, what's also interesting is this idea of the pyramids, of unearthing what was there before in Bunker Hill, which had been raised to build those shiny, boring glass office towers.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the whole story of the construction of Moca could be its own soap opera because it was such a bizarre enterprise. It was really part of this development of California Plaza. And the idea is that the Moca part would represent the 1% for arts part. And so they handed over this land to Moca where they could build their museum. But they saddled that construction with a million rules, which forced Isozaki to sort of put most of the museum below grade and essentially split his building in two in order to meet the developer's demands. They also didn't want the building to be too tall and therefore overshadow all their ugly glass towers all around. So he had to work with that. Then he had a trustee he had to deal with who at the time who decided he didn't like pyramids and barrel vaults and instead wanted just a plain box. And so this was not an easy project to undertake, and on a very difficult site. You know, this is on the side of a steep slope of Bunker Hill. It rests on top of a garage. It was not an ideal location for a museum. And I think given the constraints that he was given, he managed, you know, this innovative, interesting building that gets overlooked because it's not flashy, but it is a great place to go see art.
He also seemed to have a sense of humor. He designed one building that ended up looking like a piggy bank. And then this other thing he did, he designed a clubhouse for a golf club in the shape of a question mark because he doesn't understand why Japanese people play so much golf.
Yes, yes. I mean, this was someone who put the meticulous attention of the Japanese tradition into his work, but wasn't afraid to have fun with it, wasn't afraid to create unusual shapes or clad his buildings in unusual colors. You know, one of the buildings that he did and that he's known for is the Disney office that he did in Orlando for Team Disney. There's one here in Burbank. He designed the one that is in Orlando. Critics have talked about it as this really whimsical building that is also very good architecture that draws from centuries of both Eastern and Western traditions of architecture. But, you know, there's mouse ears at the front.
Carolina Miranda, she writes the Culture High and Low column for the Los Angeles Times. She's a regular contributor here at Press Play. We've been talking about Arata Isozaki, the winner of this year's Pritzker Prize. Thanks, Carolina.
Thank you for having me.
And Christian Bordahl is here now to wrap up the show with some listener feedback. Hi there.
Yes, hey there. So you talked earlier about how the college study abroad programs. Yes. Two-thirds of the kids that go and study abroad are women, that the men just don't do it, which is so weird to
it
me.
It is weird.
Anyway.
I mean, you know, it's fun to travel abroad.
Exactly.
Did you travel abroad?
I didn't, no.
Once again.
Yeah. I just.
Illustrating the point.
I'm here illustrating the point. But Mauricio says he had similar reasons to the author or guest for not studying abroad. He said he was also editor of his school's paper, the yearbook, and involved with multiple on-campus organizations that I didn't want to leave. But Steve LaRue says studying abroad at Oxford University in England was the highlight of my collegiate experience, and I continue to benefit from it. And he asks, where did the Mad Brand study?
La Sorbonne. And that's
it. That's high end.
Thank you very much. And goodbye. See you tomorrow.
Drop the mic.